What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. This is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
Good afternoon on this Tuesday. It is Tuesday, right, Fred? Sometimes I have to ask these questions and confirm. Unfortunately, Sue Thomas is off today because she had to tend to some moving chores on one of the hottest days of the year. So I'm sure she's enjoying that. I do think she's back with us tomorrow, though, if I'm not mistaken.
That's what I'm planning.
All right, we got a lot of stuff going on today. The aftermath of not only the meeting with Putin, but everything that happened in Washington yesterday. Some praise from even some unlikely sources, I think, when it comes to everything that Trump's been doing on that front. We have a lot of great guests coming up. There's some new news about a brand new attorney general. One of the stories yesterday we were tracking was that Andrew Bailey was going to leave to become co-deputy director of the FBI. And in fact, that did happen. And the announcement came down, I think, right before we were getting off the air yesterday. That came down officially. And then the question would be, well, who's going to replace Andrew Bailey? And I did squeeze that out of someone last night, but I was sworn to silence. It was Catherine Hanaway, who, Fred, as you know, long history here with the Mark Reardon Show. She hasn't been on in a while, but back in the early days of the Reardon Roundtable, she was on the panel all the time. She was the first female House Speaker in Missouri. She ran for governor one time and was unsuccessful. She was a U.S. attorney here in the St. Louis area, and that was a big role. So there's no doubt that she has the experience necessary. I think it's a good choice. And, you know, there's some implications here for even Andrew Bailey in the future. Does he come back and does he run for the Senate? Does he run for governor? Does Catherine Hanaway become a senator? Because, you know, you have maybe Eric Schmidt is put into the administration. If J.D. Vance, we're getting way ahead of ourselves, but there's all kinds of scenarios. People are already talking about that, Fred. What's really going to happen in 28.
That's like draft choices.
We already look for it. Like, you can't end a college football season without having the power rankings for the next college football season. It's kind of like that. We're not only looking at what the moment might be. Now, I'm a little disappointed only from this perspective. I love Andrew Bailey, and it's kind of funny, and I told him this story. Fred, the first time we ever met, I don't know, that would have been like 3 years ago, he came into the studio, which I give him credit for because a lot of these guys, they don't even, you know, take time to go out and meet the media. So he came in. He was familiar with the show. He ended up being a real big fan of the show. I hear from Andrew on a regular basis when things are said that he likes. And, you know, he sends me a text, and we love talking Mizzou basketball and football. I got to see him in person at his office in February when I went up to see the governor. So we've developed a great relationship, and I think he's doing an unbelievable job, and he has been for Missouri. You think about the Kim Gardner situation. Now, some of that was started under Eric Schmidt's watch, but you certainly give him all the credit for what happened with Jamie Reed, the whistleblower at WashU, and getting rid of the gender-affirming care at Children's Hospital. He led the way on that. So now we have a new nominee. Andrew has not responded to him yesterday. I texted him. I said, hey, I'm hearing news. Can you confirm? And I didn't hear anything. And I said, boo! But congratulations. Because I feel like, you know, we've lost a lot of good people here in our area to the administration. I think that's kudos to Missouri. Here's Catherine this morning talking about Andrew and the new role.
It is absolutely remarkable what he has accomplished in his short tenure. And he is handing off an office that is in better shape than that office has been in a very long time, and I'm eager to get there.
She talked about her priorities.
The first and most important part of this job is to protect Missourians from anyone who would do violence against them, who would rip them off in financial schemes, who would abuse them through providing terrible care and getting paid by Medicaid, and anyone who would try to invade their constitutional rights.
Now, she is a bit of an establishment pick, if you will. although Kehoe's kind of, you know, he gets tagged as an establishment guy. Our one of our Jefferson City insiders, Scott Fawn, is going to join us with his take here coming up in just a couple of minutes, and we'll continue to cover that throughout the afternoon. We've got Sean Spicer coming up this afternoon at 4:30. The one thing I wanted to spend time on here in the early part of the show, and Fred, I don't know how much you've had a chance to dig into this report, but They have issued a report on the tornado sirens that did not go off. Carmody McDonald is the law firm which conducted the review. It's a little hinky-jinky in the way that it's written. It's a very long report. There are things that we knew in this report. There are things that I think I learned in this report that I did not know. I believe that State Rep Steve Butts is going to join us to react to this in a couple hours. But let me just kind of cull it down here. And some of this is from reporting in the local paper. It says a series of failures. And I've read this whole report, by the way. It's not I've taken a couple of screen captures and I want to read from some of those, but it's not the most fluid in its narrative, if you will. If I feel like, you know, all the attorneys, all the big shot attorneys did all this stuff and they took notes, and then like the interns maybe wrote their report. But, you know, it's a complicated situation. There's all these, you know, abbreviations for SEMA, which is the City Emergency Management Agency, EOC, which is the Emergency Operations Center, NIMS, which is the National Incidents Management System, ICS, which is the Incident Command System, the EOP is the Emergency Operating Procedure. So you're going to hear some of that when I describe what happened here. The one thing, and I was trying to determine this from some of the stories that I've read, Fred, do you know if Sarah Russell, who was in charge of, you know, SEMA, she was put on paid administrative leave. I think she's still getting paid.
I haven't heard otherwise, so I would imagine.
Well, I think the one thing that you can say, there's two things I would say about Sarah Russell. I don't know her. I know that this report kind of lays her out, and at one point they say that she dithered. I thought that was an interesting word for like a report that's out from a law firm. But I'll also say this. It does seem to me, having read this, that some of this falls on Mayor Jones and the administration. Look, they knew that these sirens were a problem. In fact, Sarah Russell actually recommended that they take the system down completely and they don't use it until they were able to repair it. There was an allocation of something like $300 million that was put in place. I think it was $3.9 million to allocate it to replace the system. But at one point, you know, in this report, according to it, Sarah Russell, the person who's running SEMA, says, let's just take it offline. Let's just do the notifications via the apps and, you know, the siren that comes through on your phone. And they decided not to do that. Now, some of these things were tested literally the day before the tornado came in. And then, you know, in the aftermath, we learned a lot of different things. We know that she was at a conference with a couple other folks down the street. There was a decision, a, you know, cognizant decision made to not go back to the office, to stay and do what she was doing. When they say she dithered, I'll get to this a little bit in the report, I guess she goes into her car and she starts driving around and doing what they refer to as a windshield assessment, which is something that the cops do on a regular basis. And they ripped her for that, saying that was not something that she should have been doing, that she should have been back in the office. So the report, and again, some of this is, I'm going to pull this from the Post-Dispatch's coverage. The staffers were at an off-site workshop and away from the siren equipment. Now, one thing that's never touched upon in this report is what the off-site workshop was about, or what it was supposed to be about. And let me tell you what it was supposed to be about. A bunch of woke nonsense. That's what it was. And it wasn't going to help anyone. So the report says communication broke down between the emergency management chief and the fire dispatcher who could have triggered the sirens. Even if the dispatcher had triggered the sirens, nothing would have changed because the button that activates the sirens wasn't working. And it gets better. Even if it had been working, some sirens in the path of the tornado wouldn't have gone off because they were broken. There was a bunch of, I think, 22 plus sirens, and half of those have now been repaired, that weren't going to go off no matter what. They say the report found multiple cascading failures at almost every level leading up to and even after the storm event. That was what the lawyers from Carmody McDonald wrote. Kara Spencer acknowledged the problem. She had a statement yesterday saying, this investigation makes it clear that there were breakdowns on several levels. I'm committed to putting this report to work so the city of St. Louis can respond at the highest possible levels in any future disaster. And it does not only offer a review of what happened, but it does make recommendations what should happen in the future. The test, this is amazing, that test the day before the tornado found out that 22 of the 60 sirens were not working, including some in Forest Park and in neighborhoods just north and east of there where the tornado struck. So we do know this. Look, even if the sirens would have gone off, would it have prevented less damage? No, I don't think so. Could it have saved lives? Potentially, five people lost their lives that day. But it's a bigger issue because the whole system should work in case something else happens. And it just didn't. And it didn't for a long time, is what we're finding in this report. Now the sirens automatically activate when the National Weather Service issues alerts. I don't know why that wouldn't have been done previously. But as the Post says, it puts a point on the human failures, notably singling out Sarah Russell, the head of the City Emergency Management Agency, placed on leave after the storm. It says Russell failed to update emergency response plans as needed. It dwells on her decision to remain at the workshop and away from the city's only working siren button during the storm. It criticizes her leadership. Afterwards, they say in this report, we were troubled by Commissioner Russell's refusal during her interview to recognize the multiple failures or to take any personal responsibility for them. They talk about a couple other people that worked in that office. One was the PIO, it's the public information officer, Kim Vandenberg, and then someone else who kind of were on top of their jobs and they were doing sort of what they were supposed to do. It says that conflicting accounts dribbled out over the following days. Remember, friend, when this all happened, and I wasn't here that Friday. Right. I missed the Friday of the tornado. But there were, and I think even Steve Butt said that there was an indication that some of the sirens did go off and some didn't. After they looked into that, I guess they hadn't, you know, none of them had gone off, which is interesting because some people said that they heard the sirens. So she's put on leave after that. The report is released yesterday. It doesn't say anything in here that she was fired. I think that if there's one thing that you can take away from this, and by the way, I wouldn't put all this on Sarah Russell. It's not just her. There's people in the Jones administration. I think there's other people that worked in and around this that probably should have to have, you know, some consequences for this. But I don't know if they will. She seems like more than just a scapegoat. I think she wasn't doing her job and she wasn't doing it effectively. And there's all kinds of information, not only leading up to the tornado, but in the aftermath. Apparently, when the National Weather Service issued the warning that day, neither SEMA nor the fire department took charge of the sirens. So Russell calls the fire department and asks a dispatcher, "You got the sirens." But there's a miscommunication or misunderstanding at the time because the dispatcher thinks that Russell was asking if she had received a cell phone alert. And she said, yes, you know how people are alerted that there's a tornado, but she made no move to do anything with the sirens. The report said, given the gravity of the situation, both dispatcher Erica Moorhead and Commissioner Russell should have ensured clarity in their communications. The report says that clear policy would have all also helped. Investigators said fire and SEMA staff had several different opinions on who exactly bore responsibility for making sure the sirens went off. In the days after the storm, Spencer assigned that responsibility, remember, to the fire department. But they there was a little, you know, I guess, mystery within SEMA and the fire department about the chain of command and what should have happened. This Kim Vandenberg, who is the PIO, said there was no specific training that she was given to figure out exactly what, you know, that protocol was. When the fire department did test the siren after the storm, it failed. When contractors come out to fix it, they find that the fire department's antenna couldn't reach a device called a repeater. We use repeaters in radio. There's also this question about the FCC and some of the signals in this report. And I don't understand all of that, but there are things that I think affect that, the repeater. And most of the people who were asked about this in this report, and Sarah Russell, they weren't very clear on the role of the FCC or what the, you know, parameters might be. But because of this repeater, which was at a Southside police station, and it sends the signals to the sirens, there was no way to reach them during the storm. So that was one of the issues. And then they get to the windshield assessment. Russell drove through the affected area to conduct a windshield assessment, a task usually handled by police officers, rather than going to the city's emergency operations center to coordinate the city's response. And when everyone arrived, there was no formal response plan available to guide the damage assessment, expense tracking, and other parts of the response. And they go into a lot of protocols that were left by the wayside. So we'll continue to talk about that. We'll have Steve Butts on in the 5 o'clock o'clock hour. We'll take a break here. We're going to get a little response on the news of the day with Catherine Hanaway. We had former Senator John Lamping set up. Is it going to be Lamping? Because he was in jury duty or jury selection. And Scott Faughn was our backup. So, Fred, what are we going to do here?
We are going to go with John Lamping.
Okay,
right,
Lamping's
now,
coming up here.
Reschedule Scott.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
Unfortunately, Sue is off today. She'll be back tomorrow. Let's talk a little bit about the choice today by Governor Kehoe. Andrew Bailey goes to D.C. to become the co-deputy director of the FBI. Catherine Hanaway, pretty big name in Missouri politics, but she hasn't really been active for a while, is the replacement. Governor Kehoe makes the announcement. She held a bit of a news conference this morning. Her intentions, you know, these have been short-lived terms because people keep going to Washington. Will she serve this term out?
So my game plan for sure is to serve the next 3 years. And then if Missourians will vote for me and believe I earn a full term, then I'd like to serve a full term. That's my game plan.
Well, that might have been Andrew Bailey's game plan, too, but that did not happen because he was swept up for this new position. Former State Senator John Lamping, who was just here on Friday for the roundtable with us with his reaction this afternoon. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm doing great, Mark.
I always kind of hearken back. This is one of my favorite stories from, I'm thinking it was 2009, which would have been... you know, I think you and I probably knew each other back then, and you might have been. When did you enter into politics? When was the first time you ran for that Senate seat?
That was my year. I ran for office in 2010. We met at the end of 2009.
So back then I had, and you might not have been on the panel yet, on the roundtable panel, but Catherine Hanaway was a panelist, and Jeff Smith was a panelist. And there was a Friday before Jeff Smith was indicted for lying to the FBI that Catherine and Jeff were on the same panel. I'll never forget it, because then the story broke next week. Now, she was not the acting U.S. attorney at the time, but she damn well knew what was going on. And that was an interesting, you know, kind of one of those moments where you go back in time and say, that must have been uncomfortable maybe for both of them in that studio. But she hasn't been as active, as I indicated, in Missouri politics as of late, taking on, you know, more of a role in a firm as a private lawyer. What do you think about this choice? Well, first of all, Andrew Bailey going to Washington. Let's start with that. I don't know if you saw that coming or if there was any kind of telegraphing of that. He certainly seems to have the creds, the street cred, and the resume for that. But where does that come from?
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, I'm not surprised by it because Andrew, you know, he was very aggressively interviewing and lobbying for the U.S. Attorney General's office back in January. So it struck me as kind of odd. You know, he was appointed to office, obviously, when Eric Schmidt went to the U.S. Senate. He then had to run for an election, for a campaign for over a year to be elected. You know, he beat out my friend Will Scharf. But it seemed like almost immediately after he was sworn in, he was looking to the federal level for federal office. I don't understand. Maybe someday he'll write a book before he runs for president and explain what he was thinking. But it seemed as if he wanted to get to the federal, to higher office at the federal level, and that's what he did. I'll talk a lot about Catherine. It is unfortunate, though. I really don't like when elected officials move on after having, you know, won an election. I mean, Joanne Emerson retired the week after she ran for re-election, and another process had to begin. And I don't like the power that the governor has with all these appointments. I think, you know, he has the power to appoint, and at the same time, he has the power to appoint the incumbent, and which Catherine will be when she runs for election.
No, I understand that. So. It just seems, man, it's, with that role in particular, it seems to be happening with maybe more than any other in the entire country. If you're a Missouri Attorney General, you're getting to Washington one way, shape, or form, and you're doing it within about 2 years. That's the pattern, right, John?
Yeah, that's right. Now, having said all this, I know Catherine quite well. She's a very deep thinker. I think she's a legal intellect. She has gravitas. I have no qualms with her being Attorney General. I think that's great. I do appreciate the fact she came out this morning and said, I want to serve for 7 years. I think that's great. It's a very comfortable pick for Kehoe, though. Catherine definitely comes from, she's not from the far right. She's not from the MAGA wing. She's not from the Tea Party wing. She's from the very, very much Missouri establishment wing. She worked for Kit Bond. She and the Blunts are in the same law firm. Mike Keough is not from the far right either. It's a very comfortable pick for him. I think I was really encouraged by the fact that Catherine did commit to an extended stay in that office. We've got way too many. We've had way too many politicians that are just going from one office to the next, looking for a higher office or something. I will also want to say this about her, which is I think this is a remarkable thing that we need much more of this in politics, and especially in Missouri. It's safe. I'm comfortable in saying Catherine just took a seven-figure pay cut.
Oh, yeah.
A seven-figure pay cut annually to take this office. So if we can get people who are massively successful in the private sector to leave the private sector to serve the public, I think the public can only be a winner in the end. I'd like to see a lot more that happens. A very difficult thing to do. What is far more common is that young men and women, they try to become seven-figure earners through government. And the fact that she did it before she got back into government, I think is phenomenal.
But my question would be, why would you do that? I guess because you love the public service and you're asked by the governor. But that's a pretty dramatic pay cut. I mean, I know that she's probably fine and the bank account is okay, but still, that's a big move.
Well, it speaks to her character. I think it speaks to her. When someone says, I'm a public servant, I want to serve the best interests of the community and the public, too often those are words that sound great. But back that up with action. And again, she's a successful, very successful attorney. And she said, you know what? I'm going to spend, think about it, Mark. She just said, I'm going to spend 7 years not making $1 million or plus or more a year. I'm going to do that for my state. I'm going to do that for my country. And so, there's going to be a lot of things that I may disagree with her on. I know she came out this morning and defended glyphosate, which speaks to the corporate wing of the party that she's more comfortable with or where she comes from. But nonetheless, we got a very bright member of our the private sector and legal community to give that up to serve the interests of the state. And I think that's phenomenal.
Former State Senator John Lamping, while I have you here on Friday, we talked about the Putin meeting a little bit. It is quite remarkable. I'm going to talk with Sean Spicer in about an hour about this, what the president has achieved so far. And obviously, he was sending a message with the flyover and, the way that Putin was greeted. But look, this appears to be a guy that really wants to get something done here. He gets all these European leaders. He's highly praised yesterday in the aftermath of that. I'm not exactly sure if a Zelensky-Putin meeting is just around the corner. So some of the next steps are somewhat questionable, but he seems focused. And I love the fact that everyone's saying he's doing this for political reasons. I think he's doing this with the rest of the world to try to stop all the damn killing.
Well, I think that in our lifetimes, we've not seen someone play this role of he's a diplomat. You know, he's pulling together people with very different views of the world. Obviously, you've got two people that are at odds with each other. But I want to share with you that there was a quote he made today. It's a very Catholic quote. And what he said was, my job, I'm trying to get into heaven. And I'm not doing very well. And hopefully if I can end this war, it'll help me get into heaven. So that's a very Catholic centric view of the world. We all, our hardcore Catholics all think it's a very narrow door to get into heaven. And to have Trump actually say that out loud, it tells me that people like J.D., the Catholics around him, Rubio and J.D. Vance, are having an influence.
So Carolyn was asked about that today in the briefing a couple hours ago.
The president said on Fox News this morning that he's partially seeking peace in order to get to heaven. Was he joking, or is there spiritual motivation behind his peace deals here?
I think the president was serious. I think the president wants to get to heaven, as I hope we all do in this room as well.
I don't know if you read Selena Zito's book, Butler, which is really, really good, but there's no doubt he credits divine intervention for that, near miss at the assassination attempt. And by the way, the book is really good by Selena. I had her on finally last week, John. Listen, great to have you hop on here about the movements in Missouri politics. We might get Catherine Hanaway on the air this afternoon. We're kind of waiting for some confirmation. I'll keep you posted on that. But Senator Lamping, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
It's always great being with you, Mark.
All right, take care.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio happening now, connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
Aw, man, I played a bite from Carolyn at the briefing, but I forgot to play this one.
Andrew Bailey is extremely qualified. As you know, he's been serving with honor as the Attorney General of Missouri, and he's been brought on as another set of very credible and experienced hands to work alongside the current Deputy Director, Dan Bongino, under the leadership of the Director, Kash Patel, and the Attorney General, Pam Bondi. When you're actually working and enforcing law and order, you need all hands on deck, and so we look forward to welcoming Andrew Bailey to this new post.
And we might get his replacement as AG Catherine Hanaway on the air before this show is over this afternoon. A lot of the questions this morning with Carolyn had to do with the Ukraine-Russia situation, security guarantees in particular.
The president has definitively stated U.S. boots will not be on the ground in Ukraine, but we can certainly help in the coordination and perhaps provide other means of security guarantees to our European allies. The president understands security guarantees are crucially important to ensure a lasting peace, and he has directed his national security team to coordinate with our friends in Europe and also to continue to cooperate and discuss these matters with Ukraine and Russia as well.
So she had to address the media coverage because the legacy media is just waiting for this to fail, right?
All weekend following those historic U.S.-Russia bilateral talks, we listened to clueless pundits on television trying but failing to claim that the president had failed. The so-called experts in the foreign policy establishment, whose record is nothing but endless wars, trillions of wasted taxpayer dollars, and dead Americans, have the nerve to try and lecture President Trump, who has solved seven global conflicts in 7 months, about peace.
Carolyn, fired up about that one. There's no doubt about it. Now, I've been concerned about this conflict from the beginning for a variety of reasons. I just didn't think that this was a winnable war for Ukraine. Those circumstances may have changed, and obviously this is very nuanced. Amir Hadzik is back with us. He's retired Marine Corps Regional Area Specialist. He was an infantry unit leader in Afghanistan and an Iraq combat veteran. How are you, Amir? Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon, Mark. Great to hear you on the air, my friend.
I appreciate that. Give me a little, and the listeners, a little background, because some of this for you is certainly personal. You know this region very well. You deployed to Georgia way back in 2008 during their war with Russia, didn't you?
Yes, that's exactly right. Back in 2008, July, and I learned a great thing about the region, about the whole Eurasian area right there, which kind of set me on trajectory to finish up as a regional expert, in the Marine Corps prior to my retirement. And I kept paying attention to what's going on over there because my life has been shaped with war in Bosnia, where I'm originally from. And the whole breakup of Yugoslavia, which is sort of like a breakup of Soviet Union but miniaturized.
Yeah.
And I found a lot of parallels between wars that Russia has been involved with its neighbors and what Serbia was doing in Balkans back in the 90s. Except, the Russian and Ukraine thing is like 10 times larger because we have nuclear weapons involved and just sheer numbers are 10 times larger. So I'm really paying attention with keen eye to what's happening here to see what kind of scenario is going to work out with the peace agreement. Because, you see, when war between Croatia and Serbia finished, Croatia was allowed to liberate all of its Serb-controlled territory, regardless of Serbian minority living there, where Bosnia was not. Bosnia was sort of like a frozen conflict where you have like a Serbian part and then you have like this Catholic and Muslim part, and so that conflict is still frozen. So I'm really paying attention to what's going on in Ukraine, and I'm hoping the whole time I was rooting for a Croatian scenario where Ukrainians will be allowed to defend themselves and reclaim lost territory, rather than Bosnia scenario where it's simply going to be frozen conflict. Yes, people will stop dying, but for how long? For how long and to whose advantage?
Yeah, and
you can see Putin's, Georgia.
Well, I was going to say, Putin's not going to go back in. There doesn't seem to be any allowance right now to give back the region that's been seized. In fact, he wants, I think, a little bit more for this to work. And then I guess the question would be, first of all, can you trust Putin? And is this something that Zelensky can come back and he can sell to the Ukrainian people? One of the things, and I mentioned this, we're going to talk with Senator Talent about this after 5 o'clock, these, you know, the security guarantees which are being discussed. My question, I'd love your opinion on this, because much of the guarantees are kind of framed around what a NATO member might be afforded in and of themselves, right? They're Ukraine, not a NATO member, but they're talking about if, in fact, something would happen in the future, that you would still have the full force of NATO getting involved here. So when you hear security guarantees, do you think it's something that Putin is serious about? And then how does Zelensky sell this to his people and get out of this whole thing to end this war?
No, you're absolutely correct. And I mean, if he doesn't sell his people this settlement, you know, he might just get forced out of the office, just like his predecessor. And so that's why it's so dangerous. But as far as like these guarantees, I mean, yeah, they're talking about Article 5 style guarantees, like an attack on Ukraine would be like attack on all of the guarantors.
Right.
Who are the guarantors? Like, are we talking about UK and actual NATO members, or are we talking about Belarus or Armenia or, you know, CSCO members, you know, or Russian allies? But there are some kind of concrete security guarantees, one of which is that $100 billion of U.S. weapons and ammunition being sent to Ukraine via European nations. And also, I understand that recently at the White House summit, President Zelensky and President Trump were talking about $50 billion Ukraine and the U.S. bilateral drone program, because Ukrainians have shown us just how automated war has become, you know, in this modern era. And I think that will be really good for the U.S. military, especially since I'm planning on having at least one of my kids go into U.S. military sometime soon.
So what are you, because again, I'm going to go back to my, you know, my comments from the beginning, where I just saw, and I think a lot of people in this country, and this was discussed a lot last year during the presidential race, pouring a bunch of money into an effort for Ukraine where they don't appear to have the possibility of winning, seemed like a big waste of money. And by the way, it wasn't all cash. It was weapons, and we've sent support. But in this situation currently, it doesn't seem like either side can really win this unless there is some sort of agreement that is reached. What would your level of confidence be? Because mine would be very low, only from this perspective. I've covered conflicts across the globe for 40 years now. There's ceasefires. When you have a ceasefire, I think President Trump even alluded to this, then the ceasefire is broken. So he's talking about it in terms more of a concrete peace deal. But can Putin, because I think that Zelensky, if he sells it to his people, I think that he can abide by whatever the agreement might be. It would be Putin that would be the big question mark here, but there are economic implications here. He's losing a lot of, you know, young people, and that's got to not be popular in Russia. So does he feel somewhat pressured to do something here? But he can't come off on the losing side of this, because that won't play well for his politics.
No, I don't believe there's any pressure on Putin, you know, to make any concessions here, because his country is behind him, whether it's by force or by through coercion. You know, Russians are supporting their president, and you know, it's Russian historical fact that they use their people as natural resource, so it doesn't matter how many of them die. The thing about Zelensky, you know, at the end of the day, when Russia seized Crimea in 2014, and the world was caught with, you know, their pants around their ankles when little green men landed in Ukraine and basically seized all of these strategic objectives. What was happening in Donbas was actually a pack of gangsters who were supported by the, you know, the spy agency from Russia, FSB, etc., and GRU, who pretty much seized only civic leadership buildings, like, you know, town halls and police stations. So it wasn't like a popular uprising in Donbas where ethnic Russians rose up against, you know, Ukrainian tyrannical authorities. It was a straight up power grab with, you know, Ukraine not being ready to enforce their own laws on their own territory, while at the same time, you know, little green men were taking possession of a huge peninsula that actually President Trump correctly was talking about is very important in their hearts. So and then from there, it just kind of grew into the insurgency until it just became all out war from 2022. So, Ukrainians still do not want to give up on Donbass because, again, these are not ethnic Russians. These are Ukrainians who speak Russian language. I mean, you see, in Georgia, 2008, one of the pretexts for Russia to attack Georgia is by issuing Russian passports to Georgian citizens who live in the province that Russia planned on seizing, which is one of their oldest tricks. You know, hey, give these Russian speakers Russian passports so we can say, hey, we're justified to enter because Russian citizens are under attack. So that's why I don't trust Putin at all. I believe that President Trump speaks with a really big stick, and I hope he keeps it up. I love Show of Force in Alaska, and I hope President Trump continues projecting strength out there.
But there doesn't seem to be, in your view, is there any kind of win possibility here or peace agreement if that Donbass region is not handed over, because that's what Putin wants? I mean, they have 76% control of a good portion of that, you know, area in eastern Ukraine. This is an area that I guess is very important for industry, and some of the heaviest fighting of the war has taken place there in the last few years. So
I agree. Lots of minerals.
So
because Western Ukraine is mostly like farmlands. But look, the way I see it is possibly Georgian resolution, where you still have several Georgian provinces, states, if you will, that are not part of the Russian Federation, but are controlled by pro-Russian separatists. And ceasefire still holds, and everybody's making money, right? And because that's ultimately what I think President Trump wants to do too. You know, we want to get back to economic prosperity because, you know, this war is really not good for a global economy. And so I believe once they freeze the conflict, just kind of have Russians claim victory in their capital, have Ukrainians claim victory in their capital, but as long as killing is stopped. And then Europeans really need to pay attention, make sure that Russian influence operations are not affecting Ukraine the way they have affected Georgia most recently, where they all but have a pro-Russian government in Tbilisi.
Amir, great stuff. I appreciate your insight here this afternoon. I think it's fascinating what happened yesterday, what happened Friday. We'll see if maybe this can progress in a positive direction. I think there's a little hope now, which is good.
But it's still just as clear as the mud, isn't it?
Yep, and it probably will be in a few weeks when we talk about it again. Take care, Amir.
Thank you so
much.
We'll
see. All right. So we were talking about the former Missouri Attorney General Andrew Bailey heading to Washington as co-deputy director of the FBI. The new Attorney General, Catherine Hanaway, we covered that a little bit earlier in the show. Let me talk about Special Assistant Attorney General Devin Hogan Flanagan. She is not from Missouri. She is from Rhode Island. And this happened, I guess, when August 14th would be, I think, last Thursday night. There's a restaurant called the, this is in Providence, called the Clark Cookhouse. And there's a call. This is one of those things where, and every once in a while this happens. I shouldn't say every once in a while. It happens quite a bit, actually, with national stories. There's always a piece of the puzzle that I think is, like, missing. And you can't really determine exactly what happened. But the police were called to this restaurant it's Newport, Rhode Island. Fancy, fancy place, Newport. I had an aunt and uncle who lived there. I've actually been there once in my life. They were arrested because they were accused of trespassing at the restaurant, and they get very defensive with the cops who show up to ask her to leave. So this special attorney general, her name is Devin Hogan Flanagan. You can hear she's a little liquored up here. She's outside of the restaurant. The body cam is on the whole time. At one point, and I don't know if we have this part of the audio, she gets into the car. She goes, buddy, you're going to regret this. You're going to regret it. And she keeps saying, I'm an AG. I'm an AG. So some of this goes down this way. I guess, let me go back to the beginning part of my comment, because the piece that's missing here is what happened at the restaurant. I have read several accounts of this. I've seen some television reporting on this. I've gone through the body cam. I never really have determined what set the restaurant off to make sure that she was going to be ejected, because they didn't like the fact that she was behaving in a certain way. And at one point when the cop says, look, you want us to get out of here, they say, charge her with something, because they did not like the fact that she was there. So it all gets kind of hot when the cops get there. He has his body cam on. Apparently, she tries to make the case that you have to turn that off, because if somebody, there is something that is in law in Rhode Island that you can apparently request, if a citizen requests to turn it off, that's the protocol. But even though she does that, the Newport Police says protocol does allow for the footage to be turned off if a witness or a victim requests it and if the scene is non-confrontational, among other situations. Well, this is not non-confrontational, I think you would agree.
If I ask you to turn off the body cam, you have to turn it off, and that's your protocol.
She's a f***ing lawyer, so she knows.
Well, that's bullshit lawyer stuff, so that's not true. So we gotta go.
That's the friend that says she's a blanking lawyer. And the friend becomes an interesting part of this here in a couple of minutes. They're both in the cops' faces. They don't like the fact that the cops are touching them. And at one point, they try to cuff Flanagan.
It is. That's law.
I'm an AG.
Good for you. I don't give a shit. Let's go. We're going.
Cop doesn't care.
Let's go. Excuse, we're leaving.
Please don't put your hands on us.
Can you get your children out of here? Like, I don't know why.
Let's go.
I thought that was kind of funny, too. So it looked like if you looked at the two women, it almost looked like Flanagan was the mother. I mean, the other woman should take it as a compliment if they're the same age. They describe her as a college friend. She looks younger, though, than the assistant AG. So the cop appears to be saying, you know, you and your children or you and your daughter or something like that. But I think that was misinterpreted.
Let's go.
Come on. There are two full-grown women and mothers.
I'm an AG.
So at this point, they're trying to put the handcuffs on her and detain her, and she keeps saying over and over, I'm an AG.
What's wrong with you?
What do you probable cause to detain me for?
You're being detained because you're not leaving.
Because I'm what? You have problems.
Sir, she's not doing anything wrong.
AG.
She's not leaving.
I think that was her husband saying, sir, she's not doing anything wrong. We're not leaving. And this is, again, where it's a little mysterious to me. Whenever I see these national stories, I almost feel like there is something missing out of this picture. Like, what the hell prompted the restaurant to say, you know, we need you out of here? That has, in any of the reporting that I've looked at here, has not become clear.
All right, let's go. She's not being arrested. Let's go.
I'm not being arrested? You're putting me in cuffs? I'm not being arrested.
Do you have any weapons on you?
No. I'm an AG.
Her badge
you're
is in the car. You want to go get a badge?
Let me tell you something. You're arrested.
Get the hell out of here.
Buddy, seriously.
You're arresting an AG.
The cop stays pretty calm.
You want to arrest right now?
No. You're putting me in handcuffs and you're Mirandizing. You're not Mirandizing me.
Relax.
This goes on for a little while. They finally get her in the back of the car. She's trying to kick the door open. So is her friend, the one that was kind of misidentified as maybe her daughter. And the friend just freaks out.
Overreact. You didn't have to have this happen. Get in the car.
No, babe, no!
She's either yelling to her husband or her boyfriend.
Get back!
She's like, babe, no, don't let this happen. She's kicking the door so they cannot close her in the back of the car. I mean, total freak out. Again, to be clear, this is not the assistant attorney general. This is the friend.
Hey, I'm right here.
No, babe!
Now, the guy who is the attorney general, I mean, that gets nuts, let me tell you. Peter Noronha is his name, and he goes on a talk show yesterday. He says that Flanagan had not been placed on leave, but that a strong sanction would be coming, including a suspension without pay if he decides to retain her with the office. I'd be kind of surprised if she's retained at this point. This is what he said on the radio yesterday. Look, she's put me in a bad position. She's embarrassed herself, humiliated herself, treated the Newport Police Department horribly. She's going to take some steps to try to address that in the next day or so. He didn't really say what the steps would be. He did say that he forced her to watch the body cam and say, hey, you need to kind of review this and say it was inexcusable behavior. She knows better. I've got 110 lawyers. She embarrassed all of them in a sense. And he says, look at the body cam footage, take a few days, come back with what she thought she needed to do to make this right. We'll have to see if there's anything she can do to make it right.
Get more at 971talk.com.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.